Hi, I'm Rachel Kahn. As an RN person, I know you go where angels fear to tread. But if you're up for a spiritual adventure, you can find my program, The Spirit of Things, on the RN homepage. Now, sally forth.
Hi, and welcome to The Health Report. I'm Joel Werner. What do you think the following things have in common? Memorizing times tables, being gracious in defeat on the football field, and a recipe for tasty lamingtons. Any idea? Well, they're all things that I learned from my mum. Our mums do a lot for us, but did you know that even before we're born, they help determine how well our immune system works? That story later in the show. We also take a look at chronic kidney disease and ask the question, do the doctors of the future have an anti-obesity bias? But up first, antibiotic resistance is one of the most pressing health concerns in the world today. Very few new antibiotics are being developed, and those we do have are becoming less effective as bacteria breed resistance. But some exciting research out of Boston suggests that silver might be a silver bullet. Jim Collins is Professor of Biomedical Engineering at Harvard University.
We discovered that silver, which is in fact an ancient antimicrobial that was used millennia ago by ancient Egyptians and ancient Greeks, we showed that it can be used in very small trace amounts as basically an antibiotic booster. And our approach was, instead of trying to come up with, discover a completely new antibiotic, was instead, as engineers, we thought, could we figure out ways to use what we already have to make our commonly used and existing antibiotic arsenal even stronger than it is at present?
So can you take us through what you did? How did you couple the silver with the antibiotic?
Well, what we initially did was we wanted to first use systems engineering approaches to better figure out what silver does to bacteria. And in using these approaches, we uncovered that silver does basically two things. One, it will weaken the outer membrane, the protective layer of bacteria, making it more permeable to big antibiotics on the outside. Second, it will disrupt the internal biology of the bacteria, leading to oxidative stress, which serves to weaken the bacteria, making them more susceptible to antibiotics. And so we then went the next step and said, could we harness these two features or exploit them by basically including a very small amount of silver in solution with the antibiotics that we initially delivered to bacteria in petri dishes in our lab. And then we actually delivered the silver with antibiotics in treatments as part of mouse studies. And we found across a range of conditions that these small non-toxic levels of silver could substantially boost the killing efficacy of the antibiotics.
And this effect is seen with large molecule antibiotics and on some of the toughest bacteria we have, the gram-negative bacteria that have protective cells.
That's right. We primarily focus on the gram-negatives. And when you talk to colleagues in biotech and pharma, their number one challenge is how to combat multidrug-resistant gram-negative bacteria. And so these are bacteria like E. coli that you have with gut infections and urinary tract infections, and Pseudomonas bugs, which are involved in lung infections, particularly in cystic fibrosis patients. Why they're problematic is they have this extra outer layer, which prevents many antibiotics, particularly big ones, like vancomycin, from getting in and exerting their lethal effects. We found that silver can weaken that outer membrane, that outer protective layer, enabling now large molecules like vanco to get in. Further, we showed that silver could go after sets of bacteria that are highly problematic, these so-called persisters, that are these quasi-dormant cells that are thought now to underlie chronic and recurrent infections. And we showed that silver, again in very small trace amounts, could enable commonly used antibiotics to wipe out these persisters, as well as to treat biofilm-based infections, which are highly problematic for really any medical device that you would put in the body. And this would include artificial hips, artificial knees, or cardiac pacemakers.
In terms of the toxicity of silver and, I guess, clinical translation, can you tell us how you mitigated those effects?
So silver, you know, as I mentioned earlier, has been used for a long time. And one of its big challenges is that when you use it as a standalone antibacterial, it can be quite toxic to the patient, and that is at the high concentrations needed for silver to be itself an antibacterial, it can cause problematic side effects. We found that at the very small concentrations that we introduced, where now we're using silver as the adjuvant or the antibiotic helper, we actually didn't encounter toxicity issues in the cell cultures and in the mouse models that we did. as we think about moving this to human trials, we'll need to initially run some small trials, one, to assess the safety and the toxicity issues, and then two, to get toward efficacy. We're hopeful, though, that these small amounts will actually mitigate the potential toxicity issues, particularly if the silver would be used only for the most problematic infections and for relatively short treatment times. Typically, a 1, 2, 3, maybe 4-week course. And I think for that amount of time, for the type of silver concentrations we would use, that we're hopeful you wouldn't have significant side effects.
So where to next for you and the team? What's the next step in the research plan?
We'd like to go in two different directions. One is we would like to move this toward early clinical trials in humans. And coupled with that, we'd actually like to explore using smart biomaterials as well as nanoparticles as means to deliver in a very directed and controlled fashion the right amount of silver at the site of infection.
Professor Jim Collins of Harvard University. Last month, medical journal The Lancet ran a special series on kidney disease. It's a condition that affects about 10% of people across the globe. Professor John Bertram from the School of Biological Sciences at Monash University was a contributing author to that series. His research focuses on nephrons, the structural and functional unit of the kidney. On average, each kidney has around 1 million nephrons, but the latest research from Bertram's lab suggests that number varies dramatically both between individuals and across an individual's lifetime.
Even today, if you look in the textbooks of nephrology, the first paragraph of most articles will tell you that the normal human kidney contains about 1 million nephrons. That evidence was actually based on very few studies. Over the last 10 or 15 years, in collaboration primarily with Wendy Hoy at the University of Queensland and Mike Hewson in Jackson, Mississippi, and Bukar Diouf in Senegal, we have actually obtained kidneys from over 400 white and Aboriginal Australians, white and African Americans, and Senegalese. And those kidneys have been collected in those sites and then sent to my lab at Monash University, where we've used state-of-the-art microscopic and morphometric techniques to actually count the numbers of nephrons in this big sample. And the mean value, the average value, is around 1 million, and the textbooks are correct. But what they don't tell us is this big range that you refer to. Our lowest count is just a little over 200,000, and our highest count is 2.7 million. So there's something like, you know, at least a tenfold range. And these aren't people with kidney disease. These were people from the general population who died from the normal causes of cardiovascular disease or unexpected deaths due to accidents and so forth. So there's a big range out there that we weren't aware of. And we believe a lot of that range is set at birth because we cannot grow or make any more of these nephrons after about 36 weeks of human gestation.
And that's the thing, it's been well established in many subdisciplines of medicine that adverse events experienced both in utero and in very early life can have a significant impact on lifetime health. So what in utero and early life influences are affecting kidney health in later life?
You're quite right. Many organs do seem to be particularly susceptible for events that occur before birth and in early childhood. And the kidney is one of those. And I think it's because, as I've said, nephrogenesis, or this process of making new nephrons, ends before normal term birth in humans. So if that number is low for any reason, then that's going to be a permanent deficit. We cannot make any more. In fact, all we're going to do is lose them through the process of aging or through, of course, process of disease. What factors regulate nephron endowment, if you like, or how many nephrons you're born with? Well, we know from animal studies already that at least 30-odd genes, perturbations in a variety of genes, can influence nephron endowment. But also the environment that the fetus is developing in can impact very much on kidney development and the numbers of nephrons. Exposure to, you know, poor nutrition, to low-protein diets. There's some evidence about the effect of hyperglycemia, high glucose levels. Alcohol exposure, exposure to certain steroids, either natural or synthetic. So a whole range of factors can influence the numbers of nephrons in the developing kidney and generally result in a deficit. And this is something we really haven't focused on as a nephrology community particularly, and still are not. It's not something we're particularly teaching our medical students, for example. But now, you know, evidence accumulated in the last 10 or 20 years is showing the important role of life before birth in kind of setting a kidney up, if you like, either on a healthy trajectory, you might put, or perhaps we produce a kidney that's susceptible. Not necessarily going to lead to kidney disease, but perhaps when things are not optimal after birth, such as putting on excess weight or cigarette smoking or physical activity or metabolic disease, the evidence is suggesting that some of these kidneys are more susceptible than others, and that's really the focus of our research.
Now, it's one thing to identify risk factors, but another thing to implement effective management strategies for at-risk individuals. How does that play out?
I think what our research and research of others is showing that, yes, some children are born with a nephron deficit, and the growing evidence, and I think it's getting stronger every year, is that, you know, some of these children are susceptible. Low birth weight children, premature children are born, we know, with low numbers of nephrons. So what can we do? Well, I think what we could try to do is to identify and screen those potentially at-risk children more thoroughly than we can do now. It's not cost-effective to screen the whole population, but those children at risk, we should perhaps check their kidney function more frequently than we do now, their blood pressure. And then if we can identify when things are starting to go wrong in terms of proteinuria or in terms of reduced alterations in their glomerular filtration rate, then we do have some medicines that can help out in that regard.
Yes, and more to that, if you are one of these individuals that is born with fewer nephrons or at risk of having fewer nephrons, I mean, how easily can that deficit be attenuated by other lifestyle choices?
We cannot turn around that deficit because the formation of new nephrons finishes before birth. So unfortunately, at the moment anyway, there's no way to kind of turn on nephron formation again. So it's a matter of ultimately perhaps trying to optimize maternal health before pregnancy and during pregnancy, and maternal diet and the health of women during their pregnancies to optimize fetal and, in this case, kidney development. But after that point, once the baby's born, then it's really, I think, just a matter at this stage to monitor and screen those babies who we consider to be at risk.
So, John, where to next? What is the future of treating kidney disease?
Well, of course, new medicines to try to protect nephrons or the glomeruli, the filters, from pathology, being able to protect perhaps the vulnerable cell populations in the kidneys is very important. Another issue, of course, all of our nephron counting and nephron number is a key focus of this review. It currently has to be done in kidneys obtained at autopsy, whether they be human or in experimental animals. And that, while, you know, very powerful, is also very limiting. We cannot do longitudinal studies, for example, in patients or in animals as we test for the effects and hopefully benefits of new drugs and so forth. I've been very fortunate in the last 2 or 3 years to establish very successful collaborations with groups in Heidelberg, Germany, and also in Hawaii in the United States, where we're using magnetic resonance imaging now for the first time to be able to image and count and size all of these filters, all of these glomeruli in the kidneys. We started with rat kidneys, so we've now moved to mouse, and we're about to publish our first report on using magnetic resonance imaging to image and count and size glomeruli in human kidneys. At the moment, this is all done with kidneys outside the body, but I think it's only a matter of a few years before we'll be able to do this safely in vivo, in living animals, and ultimately in patients.
Professor John Bertram from Monash University. As John pointed out, a lot of what happens before you're born can influence your health in later life. For example, women who spend their pregnancy in rural or farm-like environments are less likely to have children who develop allergies. It was this that motivated Ralph Nannan, Professor of Paediatrics at the University of Sydney, to investigate the developmental origins of the immune system.
Well, we were always interested in how does the mother actually tolerate the fetus. Now, that is an interesting question, because if you think of it, the fetus is half identical with the mother, and it is half identical with the father. If the mother would receive, for instance, the father's kidneys, it will reject the kidneys right away. She will only tolerize these kidneys if she were on some sort of immunosuppressants. But the physiological condition of pregnancy allows this half foreign body to grow in the womb, and it grows to quite a significant size of 3.5 kilos. And obviously, we do quite well because we're all here. So that is quite an amazing miracle. Now, the processes involved in tolerizing the baby by the mother's immune system are partly understood. But on the other hand, we really don't understand them in all their depth, and we don't understand if they go wrong, what happens then. So one of the very important arms of the immune system, which normally acts on immunosuppression, on tolerance, is a specific subset of T lymphocytes, of thymus-derived lymphocytes, which regulate immune responses. They dampen inflammation, they avoid the development of autoimmune disease, and they're called T regulatory cells. Now, these T regulatory cells are involved in a whole range of disease, you know, from the development of diabetes and allergies. And we know that their fine-tuning, the exact balance of these cells to the other cells, is really an important regulatory mechanism to avoid the development of all these diseases. What we set out to investigate was how do these T regulatory cells change during pregnancy? And what we found that in comparison to non-pregnant women, these T regulatory cells were actually significantly elevated in pregnant women. We really didn't understand exactly the mechanisms why they are upregulated in pregnancy, but it is obvious that probably a soluble factor might be responsible for their elevation. And if that is the case, we thought, well, that factor could potentially also go over to the baby side and regulate the number and frequency of the baby's T regulatory cells. To our great astonishment, we found that the T regulatory cell frequency in the baby and in the mothers, in sample pairs or in dyads as we call them, were significantly aligned. That means that if they're high in the mother, they're high in the baby. And that was the first sort of interesting finding we made.
So the idea is that the mother's communicating with the baby to regulate both of their immune systems. I mean, what are some of the implications of this finding?
Well, what this could mean potentially is that if the baby comes out with high levels of T regulatory cells, it potentially has a better protection against autoimmune disease, against allergies, than if in utero and just after birth, it comes out with very low levels of T regulatory cells. Now, this is a very simplistic explanation. And what is required here are some longitudinal studies where over time we follow through. If you are born with high levels of T regulatory cells, are you able to maintain these high levels, and do they then avoid autoimmune disease and allergies, or do they then randomly develop in any direction?
And conversely, if you're born with low levels of these T regulatory cells, then to what extent is that set in stone?
Well, that's the question we are also interested in. Now, in that direction, we made an interesting discovery that in preeclampsia, one of the most common conditions of pregnancy, where we believe that the mother's tolerance mechanisms have broken down, in this disease we found that there are actually quite low levels of T regulatory cells compared to healthy pregnant women. And we know that children whose mothers had developed preeclampsia during pregnancy, that they are more prone to develop probably things like allergies or like other autoimmune disease. So there is some indirect evidence that the levels of T regulatory cells at birth might program, might predestine us to development of disease later in life. But that has to be proven, and that is ongoing research we are now conducting.
I know it's early days, but an understanding of this type of mechanism must play into the development of future therapies for, say, autoimmune disease. Is that where you see this research heading?
Well, I think that these specific subset of T regulatory cells, which we are looking at, are the target of many pharmacological agents at the moment, because they are fine-tuning the immune system to avoid exaggerated immune responses. So in the long term, if this mechanism turns out to be proven that it has a long-term effect on the baby's health. There would be potential that you could modulate the frequency of T regulatory cells during pregnancy to avoid exactly the development of autoimmune disease and allergies.
Ralph Nannan, Professor of Paediatrics at the University of Sydney's Nepean Clinical School. You're listening to The Health Report on RN. I'm Joel Werner. And now to that story about fat bias in medical students. Obesity is a significant health issue both here in Australia and in the United States. Rates of obesity are on the rise, and along with them an alarming new trend, anti-obesity bias. David Miller is an Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and Public Health Sciences at Wake Forest School of Medicine in North Carolina.
Currently, a little over two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese. What we've noticed, though, in the States, particularly in the last 10 years, has been an anti-obesity bias that you can pick up on in society in general. And others have started to report that people at the workplace, people in school, are facing discriminations in different settings. We've even had reports of patients saying that they have perceived discrimination in the medical office. And that's what got us interested in this topic with medical students.
So it seems almost self-explanatory, but could you just tell us a little bit about what an anti-obesity bias is and how it might play out in a medical setting?
So an anti-obesity bias is another way of saying that somebody has a gut negative reaction against obese individuals. And there's really two types of bias that we can think of. One is this implicit or unconscious bias. And then a second is the explicit or your conscious bias. So what you think you prefer or how you think you would act around others. We really focused on both, but we particularly looked at this implicit or unconscious bias. How this can play out in care is if a physician has a preconceived notion about a patient, a negative notion of a patient, before he or she even sees that person, they're more likely to react negatively to them, even if it's just a flash across their face. Taking it to another level, it can affect their decisions about treatments. It might affect their decisions about diagnoses. It might affect how likely they think the patient is to follow through with treatment recommendations. And so it might affect whether they even discuss dietary lifestyle counseling. If a physician thinks, oh, this patient is very unlikely to follow a diet or an exercise routine, they may not decide to spend much time discussing that, if any at all.
Obesity bias is what you wanted to investigate with this study, and in particular, obesity bias in medical students. Can you tell us what you did?
As part of our family medicine clerkship, which occurs during the third year of medical school, we had all of the students take an implicit association test. And this is a computer-based test that measures people's unconscious preferences for one group over another. And we specifically had them take the implicit association test for fat versus thin people. And I'm going to use the words fat and thin because those are the words that actually appear in the test. And so we had all the students take this test, and then we used it as a launching point to talk about bias and then to have a discussion with the students afterwards to get their reactions to it. After 3 years, though, we were very curious to see what exactly is the rate of bias present in students, and do the students even acknowledge or are they aware of their bias?
Can you explain the IAT in a little bit more detail? I think our listeners would like to understand exactly how you measure that implicit bias.
The IAT is actually available online, and if any of your listeners are curious, they can just do a search for Project Implicit and they'll find the website, and they can take one of these tests themselves for free. But basically, the implicit association test is based on this concept that it is easier for us to pair things that are similar than it is things that are dissimilar. And a very common example is to think of a deck of cards. If I gave you a deck of cards and I said, please go through the deck very, very quickly and put all of the hearts and diamonds in this pile on the left and put all of the spades and clubs in this pile on the right, you would be able to do that very quickly because you're going to just see red suits and black suits and you're going to pair them together. But if instead I asked you and said, would you please now put all of the diamonds with the clubs here and all of the hearts with the spades here, it's going to take you much longer to do that because there's no similar attribute that you're grouping both the suits into. So the implicit association test uses the same principle, but instead of cards, we show you images of fat or thin people, And then we show you words that either have positive association or negatives, such as nasty, wonderful, pain, words like that. And we at first will ask you randomly to either pair all of the good words with the images of the fat people and the bad words with the images of the thin people, and then we'll ask you to do the reverse. And what the computer program does is it times how long does it take you to sort these words and pair them with these different images. And the idea is that if you think of thin people or fat people more positively, you will more rapidly pair the good words with that group of people. And by measuring the differences in these timings at the very end, we come up with an estimate of how much stronger you have a preference for one group compared to another. Or another way of saying that is how much of a bias do you have against one group compared to another.
And I guess for the explicit bias, it's a lot easier to measure.
Much easier. For the explicit bias, we just simply ask the students, in general, do you prefer thin people to fat people or vice versa? We gave them some choices. You could say, I slightly prefer, I moderately prefer, I strongly prefer. One thing I'd like to point out is in our paper, we chose to kind of consider the slight preferences neutral. We really focused our analysis to those students that had a moderate or strong bias.
And so tell us what you found. What were the results?
Well, the very first thing we found is that students felt very comfortable in this anonymous survey to tell us that they preferred thin people compared to fat people. Over 70% of the students said, I prefer thin people to fat people. Only 4 of over 300 students said, I prefer fat people. And none of those, it was more than a slight preference. Now, that's the overall preferences. We then said, okay, well, we really just are interested in moderate or strong preferences. And using that metric, we found that 1/3 of the students said that they moderately or strongly preferred thin people to fat people, and nobody had a moderate or strong preference for fat people. Looking then at the unconscious results, we found that about 40% of students, roughly 2 out of 5, had a significant anti-obesity bias. The much smaller percentage, 17%, actually had an unconscious anti-thin bias, but none of those students could believe that they were really anti-thin. All of them thought they were neutral.
And so do you know how many students had both an explicit and an implicit bias? Was there much of a correlation there?
There was no correlation whatsoever. We did a couple different statistical tests to see if what students thought their bias was matched what their unconscious bias was, and there was absolutely no relationship at all.
Now, being biased, consciously or otherwise, is one thing, but acting on your bias is another. Do you have any idea how this obesity bias might play out in practice?
What the psychology researchers have found is that although both explicit and implicit bias does affect behavior, it really seems to be this implicit, this unconscious bias that is driving behavior and driving prejudice. Patients do pick up on this because in other studies, a large number of obese and overweight patients report detecting negative reactions from healthcare providers. A good number of patients report delaying care. Some women report delaying cancer screening services because of this perceived weight bias in the medical office. Other studies have shown that if you show students an image of an overweight patient versus a normal weight patient, it changes the diagnosis they think that the patient has, and it also changes their views about how well this patient is going to follow therapy. Doctors believe that overweight patients are less likely to follow therapy than normal weight patients, and so it affects the treatment that they give, and it also affects the patient-physician relationship.
Associate Professor David Miller from the Wake Forest School of Medicine in North Carolina. To find out more about any of our stories, just head to the Health Report website, go to the Radio National homepage and select us from the program list. But that's all for this week. Bye for now.